Hey, welcome back to the Using Microsoft VDI to Enable New Work Styles. I am Senior Technical Evangelist Joey Snow, and now, in front of the camera instead of behind in Q&A, I bring to you VDI Product Manager Adam Carter.
Technical. Technical product manager.
Sorry.
To be clear.
Yes, it's the technical product manager.
Somebody took a little bit of a shot earlier in chat saying, oh great, we have a marketing guy talking to us.
You're the tech guy.
I'm the one with cred.
So it's time to, as if the last session we didn't put the propeller heads on, we're going to put them on now and kind of dive in and kind of talk about the design of the large-scale VDI infrastructure. But first, I understand you actually fixed Corey's demo.
Yeah, if you want to flip back to the display here after Corey left, I had to come and fix it for him, as is often the case. But you can see here now we are actually hitting the cache. We booted the machines and it's done a great job of caching. That last session was actually a great segue into this one because you guys put in a great baseline of how are all the ways I can configure my storage, and that's what we're going to talk about now.
So, agenda-wise, what we're going to do is just so folks are prepared, and again, this is a lot of just discussion kind of around all of the things that you have seen, so there's not a lot to show apart from graphs and things, which are really important because one of the things that people run into when they're doing VDI is okay, I'm going to do VDI, now I need to figure out what do I have to go buy or what do I have to improve in my current architecture. And if you take some of these things, even though we're talking about scale, and by scale we're talking 5,000 pooled desktops or a mixed deployment of pooled and personal, those numbers, it scales down as well, yes? So the learnings that we've got here help in your implementations.
I mean, we kind of went after a big one. What do we think, you know, what's a big environment that's going to, you know, a design that would support the majority of users out there. And we figured we'd start it with 5,000. Let's see what happens if we deploy a 5,000 seat one and find out what those learnings are. What does the disk IO look like, mem usage, and things like that. So what we're going to show, kind of the case study, the second half of this discussion, we'll say, hey, if you wanted to deploy 5,000 pooled VMs, here's a potential architecture you could use. But yeah, this would certainly scale down. There are solutions out there from a lot of the major vendors who have done all of this workload testing for you, and you can just go and say, I need a 350-seat VDI solution, and they will ship you, here's the boxes, here's the storage. We've already done all the load testing for you. We know this is what this will scale to. So our friends at Dell, HP have those out now. There are more coming from other vendors. But yeah, you can call Dell, say, I need a DVS-100, and they will send you all the boxes you need, all ready to go.
Awesome. So there are some things here around performance in VDI that I think we should cover off first.
Yeah, there's a couple of things that I really want to talk about here. System load is sensitive to usage patterns. I guess I'll just read the slide. what that means is, you know, if you look at a PC during the day, there's peaks and valleys in when the usage is. 9 a.m. at login time. Actually, you know, you've got boot plus login at 9 a.m. when someone gets to work. Lots of disk I/O that happens there. During the day, you know, obviously it's going to drop off at lunchtime, going to drop off at breaks, but it's pretty standard during the day. And then you get another big spike at 2 a.m. Tuesday morning when we patch that PC. But generally speaking, it's just going to depend on your usage patterns. And then you have to take that into account when you're building your solution. If you need everybody to log in at 9 a.m. within 30 seconds, you're going to need to size a solution that will support that workload. Versus if you're doing a, you know, if it's okay, if it takes a few minutes longer to log in, because to give you an idea, when Corey talked about IOPS in the last session, and that's really tends to be the biggest bottleneck in VDI solutions. CPU, we're pretty manageable. We can put a lot of CPUs in a server. RAM, because of dynamic memory and just the great memory management in the OS. You know, we kind of know that a gig or two of RAM is going to be plenty for users, and we can allocate that on the servers. Disk tends to be the hardest bottleneck to deal with. So a typical VDI user just doing regular office stuff, Outlook, Word, surfing the web, that's about 10 IOPS per second.
Okay.
That's not too bad.
No, not bad at all.
Boot and login can be as many as 200 IOPS per second.
Wow.
So 20 times that.
Yeah.
So again, that's when you're designing your solution, you need to figure out what your priorities are. Are you okay with there being a little bit of queuing and a slower login? Then, you know, build for that 10 IOPS scenario. Mm-hmm. But if you really need that to be fast, login's got to be instantaneous. You're going to have to build a solution that supports 200 IOPS times however many users you're going to support.
Okay. One of the kind of questions that I get all the time, I mention a lot that user experience needs to be very, very similar to as if I was to sit down at my actual desktop. I need to have that similar experience. From your communications and talking with customers, talking with partners, do you find that people go to the extreme and go, I need every single step along the way to be at performant, or do you try to find some middle ground there?
We see both, and obviously it's up to you to determine what your priorities are. So we see both types of solutions. Call centers, you know, that follow the sun, that have three shifts working, 5 a.m. when shift A comes off and shift B comes on, we've got to have that login happen fast because we've got to get those guys right onto the phones and ready to work. So those guys build differently than somebody that's putting in maybe as a remote access solution or has a smaller set of users.
Okay.
And so we'll talk about kind of the learnings that we had here. The other thing I want to talk about is how do we come up with these workloads? How do we simulate 5,000 users working? And the nice thing is there's a great tool for this made by a company in our friends in the Netherlands called Login VSI. So they basically have created a tool which you tell it, you build your solution, build your gold VM, deploy it, and then you install Login VSI, and you run these simulations. You tell it, hey, I need to simulate 100 users, log them all in within 20 minutes of each other, and then run this simulated workload for an hour or 40 minutes. And it creates all those logins, so you can see what your broker, what your gateway, what the load is on all of those things. And then it starts working. After they're all logged in, it just fires off a script. Open Word, open Outlook, edit a document, open a PDF, surf some YouTube. It creates all this simulated workload for you. The other thing that it does that's very cool is every one of the actions that it takes, it tracks what's the latency, what's the response time from when I clicked open to when I got that file open dialog. And it measures what that is, and once it exceeds a threshold, which I think is 200 milliseconds or something like that, that's when a user will notice this is slow. So it will flag as part of that simulation, hey, you told me to run you told me to run 100 users. When we hit the 90th user, we started getting a laggy solution. Stuff quit failing within the threshold that we had set, or stuff quit completing in the threshold that we had set. So at that point, you know, you look at your perfmon counters and say, what happened there? Okay, we maxed out RAM on our Hyper-V server, so we started swapping to disk, which created disk I/O, and that's where it got slow. But you really need to look at that and figure out what caused all that disk I/O, because really the solution here would be add RAM, not put in faster disks.
Right.
So you have to kind of analyze the results.
So the good thing here is that this tool enables you to really kind of figure out what your own personal VDI infrastructure is. So use some of this data to help guide those principles, and then get it in before it's ever in front of a user. And demonstrate those workloads.
And we've got a video, right? You can kick that off. It's sometimes easier to visualize what is this thing and kind of understand what it's doing.
Sure, absolutely.
So but what we can do is fire off a video, which is very simple. It just says, hey, let's fire up about 10 sessions and start this medium workload. And
okay.
You can define, and Login VSI, the nice thing is, this is a standard. Everybody uses Login VSI. All the OEMs use it, so they can tell you, you know, we use Login VSI and we hit max at 180 users, so we say this box is safe for 150. But you can see here it's logged in. It's got a couple of sessions started here. It's logging them in. It's just going to wait and then kick off these scripts. So you'll see as this goes, it's going to keep logging in sessions. Unfortunately, it just stacks all of them on top of each other, so it's a little hard to tell without looking at the taskbar that there are multiple sessions starting. But you'll see once they get going.
Yeah, and you'll see here. I can jump ahead
a little bit, maybe, and you can kind of see. Now you can see in the script there, it's starting to open emails, open websites. And in this case, this runs about 40 minutes, so that's how we'll spend the rest of our time, is just watching this.
Are we just going to watch the video? Sounds good.
I'm kidding. Yeah. But anyway, so it'll, at the end, spit you out some very nice reports. Here's how long it took to get everybody logged in. Here's where we were. This is where you hit max. Maybe you never hit your maximums.
Okay.
So we came up with this solution. Let's build a 5,000 seat architecture. What do we think we're going to need in terms of storage and things? And then we ran Login VSI against it and got these results. So you can kind of think of this section. What we're going to talk about for the next 40 minutes is a little bit of a case study result in what it takes to do that.
All right. So again, folks, what you've looked at and the load that you've kind of targeted here, provisioning of VMs, going through boot, going through the login phase, and then doing very, very typical user daily workload stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yep. Okay, very cool. And is this the ideal scenario that you typically design for when you're going through this? Is that you don't design for your highest user, you kind of design for the average?
Yeah, and you want to profile. And there are some great profiling tools out there as well, Liquidware Labs, 10 Tricks. There's a bunch of companies that make some profiling tools, as well as our own Map Toolkit has some capacity planning stuff to kind of figure out how much, what users are doing what, and so I can start to categorize which ones make good candidates to put into VDI, and is it going to work for a pooled environment? Do we need to allocate a personal disk for them based on their usage? So you can kind of start to build some of that information.
All right, well, let's just jump into designing a large-scale VDI deployment and the things that you guys kind of took into account. So I guess here, this slide talks about a walkthrough of a 5,000 seat VDI deployment, where you've got 80% of your users running on a network on the LAN. You're not seeing my slides because of my video, probably, huh?
Yeah.
There we go.
So we came up with what we figured was a pretty typical user environment. 5,000 seats, we'll assume 80,000 of them are in the office, connecting on or some office location where they've got a high-speed connection, a LAN connection, and the rest are connecting over the internet. That means we're using the RD gateway, which you can kind of think of as it's kind of a VPN light. It's mm-hmm. just for access to a VDI or remote desktop solution over SSL, which puts a little bit of extra overhead on that server that's doing that translation. But that's the idea, is let's kind of build for that. What we'll do is kind of talk about what the options are. We did a lot of talk in the last module about storage. So let's look at the pros and cons of some of those. We'll do some of the math around what kind of storage you need to put together. And then there's a few little tweaks and optimizations you can make as you go to help get you there.
Okay.
All right. So let's start off with the VDI management servers. So when I say there's really two sets of servers in this solution. There's the ones that deliver all the plumbing, the broker, the licensing server, the web and gateway. And we just need a couple of those. 5,000 seats, you can easily do this on one server, two for high availability. The bulk of our solution to get to 5,000 seats are just what we call RD virtualization host. RDVH machines can be Hyper-V server, can be a copy of standard server or data center server, but those machines are really just Hyper-V, role, and a bunch of client VMs. So let's start with the management nodes, though. How do we do this? We call this optionally clustered, so if you're looking at the left side of the screen there, because all of the RD web components aren't actually clustered, none of them are designed to be clustered, you don't have to cluster the host that's got this. But the idea here is, let's take one server, two virtual machines in it, could be two servers with virtual machines if we want to move them around. But here's the roles that we have running there. We've got those infrastructure roles, gateway, web, broker, and things like that. Those management VMs we're going to put on shared storage, so we can kind of migrate them to any machine in our data center, embrace the private cloud. Mm-hmm. And again, you can see we've made a bet here on Windows storage spaces. We don't need to have a SAN in this solution. None of the stuff I'm talking about in the solutions we looked at, did we leverage a SAN? You certainly can. And there's things in a SAN like online disk dedupe and things like that, and some additional caching beyond what we do with CSV cache. So it's kind of pick the solution that works for you. If you've already got a big investment in a SAN, yeah, use it. If you don't have an investment in a SAN, just start buying some fast disks, set up a share like this.
Okay.
And like Corey described, scale out files, cluster here, so we can share that we've got the shares on two machines and we can load balance against them as needed.
Okay, simple enough.
Pretty straightforward here.
And we'll jump ahead.
Now, in terms of the scale and perf that we can do with that, so remember, we talked about the scenario where we've got 20% of our users coming in through the RD gateway. So that's about 1,000 users if we're building this 5,000-seat solution. A gateway can support that. A gateway can support 1,000 by itself. But we want to build everything for high availability because we don't want that 1,000 users not being able to work if the gateway goes down. So we have two in high availability. And you can see some of the statistics there. Each connection is about 60 kilobytes of traffic just to get that connection going. And if we're using that VSI medium workload, that's a standard user, Office, Outlook, some browsing, it generates about 62 kilobytes per second per user that you can see there.
And you're dealing here in terms of your actual physical host on this is you've got dual Xeon processors here, each with 8 cores on it. So we've got 16 total CPUs as I'm as I'm kind of looking through the notes here. And then your configuration is you assign a couple of those cores to each one of those machines, and only 8 gig of RAM.
Not a whole lot of workload on the gateway. It's not doing a whole lot. It's really, again, it's I.O. It's network I.O. is where most of the work is there. It's doing some work as it translates that RDP traffic to SSL, but it's not a tremendous load considering it's got 1,000 users pumping through it at any given time.
So the next piece, this is kind of where the bread and butter is, right? It's our broker.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and the broker's a funny thing. I don't know where the conversation started, but there's always this perception that our broker doesn't work, our broker doesn't scale, I need to use a broker from somebody else if I want any degree of scale. And I think we weren't sure in 2008 R2 how high our broker would scale, and it turns out it's easier to write a broker than we thought. So we did it in 2012, and we've got a great broker. For high availability with the broker, it's really simple, and you saw it in the admin tool. Set up a SQL server, cluster your SQL server, and then just tell your brokers, configure for high availability, point them at that SQL server, and you're done. We let the SQL guys who know how to cluster, they built their cluster. We're just pointing multiple brokers at that database.
Okay.
And you'll see here, again, the load is not terribly high. We had no problem getting 5,000 connections all logged in less than 5 minutes.
Wow.
Again, we configured 2 brokers for high availability. And you can see there about 50 connections per 2, you know, within just about 2 seconds we're able to push that through. And again, not a high load on these machines. We did these with single core machines and 4 gig of RAM.
Wow.
In a virtual machine, so they were in high availability. Even the SQL server, you can see for 5,000 seats, that SQL database is only about 60 meg, not a huge database. It's really just tracking the state. Is this user already logged in? Which machine is he logged into? Does he already have a session open that I can redirecting to? Do I need to create a new one? Are all my VMs currently in use? Do I need to spin up more VMs? That's really kind of the stuff that the broker is doing. And you can see there what we put together for that. You can see the transaction count as you're scaling your SQL server. When you create VMs, you got a bunch of activity on the database as it provisions those new virtual machines. And then every time a user logs in, there's some transactions as we figure out, do they already have a session? Do I redirect them to it? Do I create a new one?
Yeah, and these were pooled, which is why you typically see, you know, if we're logging in and having to create 100 new VMs because it's a pool. But even still, at 1,100 transactions, I mean, SQL Server's going to look at that and laugh, right? Yeah. It's just basically going to be like, move along, nothing to see here.
Yeah, not a whole lot of work happening there.
Okay.
A couple little tweaks that are interesting here. When you provision a collection and you tell it, I want this collection to have 100 machines in the pool, or I want to have 200 machines or 1,000 machines, whatever your number is. When you click go create the collection, by default, we create those one at a time. So we create a VM based on that parenting disk, we boot it up, it gets joined to the domain, we create a differencing disk for it to store that domain join information. And once that's finished, we start the second one. Boot it up, join it to the domain. So it's serial, and it's, you know, depending on how fast your storage is, 5 minutes, 10 minutes per machine.
And that's the default, and the default is like that for a reason, yeah?
Because it's safe, because we don't know what is your storage scenario. Are you using shared storage? Are these local disks? Am I going to break everything else if I enable this? So by default, we just do one at a time. And there is here a command, PowerShell commandlet right there. You can bump that value up. We do up to 5 at a time right now. That was kind of our testing threshold. But again, this is just for creating VMs or when the patch cycle comes around and you're refreshing that gold VM. So this is something that, you know, it happens after hours anyway, typically. Mm-hmm. And so you can allocate the time that it's going to take to do that.
Okay.
And you can see there, we can double or triple, or we can reduce by half or a third how much time it takes to do these deployments.
Okay, cool.
All right. So VDI compute and storage nodes. This is where things get interesting. This is where most of our work happens at. Well, let's walk through 3 different scenarios. 1, all pooled VMs.
Okay.
Nice thing about user profile disks, we can still have users to have their persistent configuration, but we only have to manage that one base image. It's a great way to do it. We're going to do it both ways. Local storage, because we talked about that, throw a solid state disk in for the gold VM. And we'll also talk about centralized storage. How can we do that using that SMB 3.0, CSV cache, all that other cool stuff? How does that come into play? And then what is probably a pretty common environment for people, what if I've got some personal VMs, some pooled ones, what does that mixed environment look like? How does that affect all my storage?
Okay.
This is where we start to get into some crazy numbers, because you think, you know, I look at the amount of storage it takes to support 5,000 users, and you know, it's multiple terabytes. But remember, that's for 5,000 seats.
Yeah.
That's a big company.
Yeah.
So let's go through some of this. So what we came up with, and we just kind of, you know, we looked at it on the board and said, we've got these servers, they've got 192 gig of RAM in them. If we're allocating a meg and a half per user, 150 seats, 150 virtual machines per host is probably what we can do. So if you do the math, 150, you know, 5,000 divided by 150, we're going to have like 35 machines that are just virtualization hosts. And that's what we're going to go to.
Do you need me to go back to this diagram? I mean, this diagram is essentially the same.
Pretty straightforward. Yeah.
Here, we've got disks there. Yeah.
Yeah. The point here is most of our storage is local. So you can see we're going to have our gold image. We've got a boot image that's booting the local OS. Could be Hyper-V server. Could be Windows Server 2012, standard or data center. And then we've got a bunch of 10K disks in a RAID. In this case, we actually did 10 disks in RAIDed to get us to that IOPS number we needed.
Okay.
And remember, that's 10 spindles, and then if you're mirroring that, you're going to have 20 disks. I mean, that's the kind of thing you got to think, keep in mind, if you're RAIDing all this data.
Yeah.
Then you're going to have double the disks.
Double the disks. Yeah.
Now the user profile disk, the user VHD, we got to keep that on a share, so that because it doesn't matter which hotel room we check that person into, they need to get access to that UPD for their personalization. So we keep that on a share that's accessible from all of those 35 VDI hosts.
And is that stored still locally? Or are you storing that off into your other, in the picture here, the JBOD enclosure, yeah, and those clusters?
Yeah, the user profile just sits on a share,
okay,
somewhere.
Okay, cool enough.
Just like you do with people's home directories.
Yeah.
Kind of think of,
yeah,
it as the same type of scenario.
Okay, easy breezy.
Okay. So here's the machines that we had. As I said, we put about 150 machines per CPU or per server, and you can see the CPU numbers here. These were 2.9 gigahertz machines. At 150 users, we only hit 80% of CPU. So we had some headroom there. We could have potentially increased the number of users there. But again, these were simulated users. In real life, some will be more power users, so we like having that headroom there. That's a pretty recommended number from,
okay,
us. For memory, again, we allocated 1 gig per Windows 8 VM.
Okay.
It's enough for a typical medium workload user. That's plenty of RAM. As I said, the server supports 192, so even if all 150 gets utilized, we're okay. Now we get into traffic on the wire. Okay, so we've got 5,000 users all connecting into our data center. What does that traffic look like?
Mm-hmm.
Now, as we talked about in the first session, as you guys talked about, RDP has made some huge improvements at the protocol level for how much bandwidth it consumes. What we see when you're running that medium workload is about 500 kilobits per second. Times that by 5,000, you've got 2.5 gigabits of traffic now coming into your network, and that's just screens and mouse clicks going back and forth between the
endpoints. So it's nothing too massive.
It's pretty manageable.
I mean, manageable, right?
Yeah. And again, that's going to be split across that group of servers. So you just got to make sure your switch can support that much coming in. Now that's really, we've got 80% of those users on the LAN. Another 20% or 1,000 of those users are coming in through the internet. So those are hitting the gateway. So the gateway, yeah, you know, you need to be able to support 500 meg of inbound traffic on the WAN. So Corey's house apparently is where you're going to want to host those, and 2.5 gig on the LAN. So that's kind of where the breakdown comes from.
Okay,
that's the kind of network you're going to need for 5,000 seats.
Okay.
So what does the storage look like? Now remember, this was a solution that was all local storage except for the user profile disk. We kept that on the network so it can access from anywhere. But basically, what we've done is taken that gold VM, dropped it on every machine as a local copy of it there, and then the differencing disks we've also got on that local machine too.
Okay.
So everything's happening local, no SAN here. And as we talked about before, standard user during regular work time, 10 IOPS per user, times 150 users per host, that's, you know, 1,500 IOPS. And then we've got a breakdown here. Where are those IOPS actually hitting?
Mm-hmm.
The majority of the reads are happening on that gold VM. Because that base image, we got to boot the machine, we got to log in, our apps, we'll say, are installed in that gold VM. That's where most of our read traffic is. But if you look here and you kind of do the math, about a third, maybe a little more than a third of your traffic is write traffic. which is a little more expensive. You can't really cache it.
Right.
But you can see here where that is. The majority of that is actually on the differencing disk, because it's things like the page file and things, so they're hitting that local differencing disk. And then a portion of that is also the user profile disk, which we've got on a network share. So you can see here, here's where the traffic is. Here's where to start thinking about how to optimize your storage. And then, hey, when you do the math, let's say your gold image is 20 gigs. The differencing disk for each of the children based on that is about 5 gig.
Okay.
So 5 gig times 150 plus the 20 gig means each machine is going to need, you know, a couple of terabytes is really enough storage locally there. Not too bad.
Okay.
So some of the things to be aware of, the SMB low, because the user profile disk is on the network. So we need to be aware of that traffic on the network. 2 IOPS per user, which is pretty typical for, you know, the amount of traffic hitting their documents versus hitting the OS that's local.
Okay.
That comes out to about 10,000 IOPS, and they're generally mostly writes. And so you can see there, when you do that math, you got about a half a gigabit of second of traffic between the machines running the RDBH hosts and the shares where your user profile disk is located.
Okay.
So as you're thinking of data going through the data center, we got that 2.5 gigabits of traffic coming in to connect to those servers, and then another half a gig going out so they can talk to their profile disks.
Still very reasonable, very manageable under most LAN scenarios, and even WAN scenarios, it's still pretty doable. You're not having to go to some extreme, you know, double lines into your garage like Corey does.
Right. And in terms of storage, though, for 5,000 users, you're looking at about 50 terabytes of storage. That's before you rate it.
Okay, so we're starting now. You're starting to kind of hit that slope now, right? Where you're like, okay, we need speed because we've got IOPS. But if you look at the previous graph, right, we showed where those IOPS happening. A lot of them are read, so caching can come into play here. But you're also looking at okay size now. You're starting to get in near those thresholds of like, okay, speed versus size decisions have to be made, types of disks that can support this, or you're just going to be dumping a ton of money into that.
I mean, you saw a ton of the reads are happening on the gold image. We know that's going to be 20 gig or 40 gig, whatever your standard desktop image is, but then on a solid state disk. But on solid state, so you can hit it really fast. Or put it on, you know, Corey mentioned Fusion I.O. cards. You can do that. You can expose that as block storage and just use that as a drive where you host that gold image. So there's ways to really accelerate where all those reads are coming from. And then it's just thinking about how do I get enough throughput for the writes that are happening.
So one of the things that in the next slide kind of covers this is for optimization, using those SSDs for gold VMs. And look at this reduction in IOPS versus spindle disks.
Yeah.
I mean, around 45%. That's impressive. Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty low cost, right? That's maybe one or two largest solid state disks in each of those, well, times 35 servers if you're going to 5,000.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's, you know, it's fairly inexpensive, and it's addressable. And that's, you can get that kind of disks in a local server versus having to go to some big massive disks in a big disk array that we're connecting to.
So the point that you made too there, I think it's important to call out to folks at home as well. You've got that, it's only a couple of SSD disks times 35 servers if you're doing 5,000 users. Mm-hmm. If I'm doing 50 users, you're still going to be able to reap these benefits because you're looking at this purely at an IOP level, right? In other words, it's like, okay, the numbers move along down the scale as well, because you are averaging, these are IOPS, these are things that we see with the normal average user's workload. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to note, a lot of times, I mentioned this before when we started with Corey, everybody's like, oh, I'm not going to pay attention to this, they're talking about 5,000 seats. Well, wait a minute, let's take these learnings and go down to the purest form, which is how we're looking at it.
Yeah.
Per user, we're dealing with this, so be prepared for that.
Yeah, we're also thinking of 150 users per server.
Yeah.
So, you know, think about how big your environment is and how many servers you need at 150 per, and kind of apply that, you know, and then just do the math on your own.
Yep.
For yours.
And it does mention here on the slide, SSDs for gold VMs is recommended for hosts that support more users over that 250 user barrier.
Yeah, if you would rather, you know, if you just want a bigger basket to put your eggs into, you could certainly go beyond 150 users on a server, go with bigger servers than what we'd spec'd out.
Okay.
And more RAM, obviously, to support them.
Gotcha. So now let's transition. We were talking local storage. Now let's talk about SMB storage and start talking about the stuff that we talked about in our previous module, right, where we set everything up with SMB3 and those kinds of technologies that we've got there.
Right. Yeah. And this is where, you know, Corey talked about CSV cache and how cool it is to allocate that. This is where we start taking advantage of things like that. Local storage, we use SSDs. Cluster storage, we can use CSV. So pretty similar environment here. Basically, our VDI hosts, we've just got OS boot disks in them. We're just booting the OS. And then we're connecting to shares for all of our other information. User disks, the gold VMs, the VM differencing disks. We're putting that all on shared storage. And we actually did all this with just two machines in a cluster. Use that scale-out file cluster, so we load balanced across the two. But that's what we did it with, was just two. Mm-hmm. Let me show you some of the numbers that we got there. So CPU, memory, RDP load, that doesn't change. That's the same. 150 users, hit 80% of CPU. I gave everybody a gig of RAM. And we know what that traffic is, 500 kilobits per user times, give us that 3 gig or whatever. That number doesn't change. The storage load is where things change. Because we got 5,000 users, we've now got to put together a solution that supports 50,000 IOPS per second. And here's how we did it. When you look at that breakdown, you can see the gold VMs got 22,000 of those, mm-hmm. and they're mostly reads, which is good news. But then you've got a bunch of stuff hitting the differencing disks, a mix of read and write, and then the user VHD, which is pretty much exclusively writes.
Okay.
So in terms of now, just do the math on that. The gold VM is 20 gigabytes per collection. Now that depends how many collections you have. So think of your standard desktop images. How many of those do you have in your company? Mm-hmm. Do you have, you know, two or three different standard desktop images? Do you have 10? Do you have 50? Well, however many of those you've got, standard images, times that by 20 gig per, if that's the size of your basic. And you'll see that for the gold VM, you know, if we've got 10 different base images that are all 20 gig, we've got 200 gig that we need. If it's you know, as many as 50 different base images or collections, you know, then the size goes up from there to a terabyte. Differencing disks, that's still 5 gig per VM. That number doesn't change. And then the user VHD, we're assuming 10 gigabytes per user is a reasonable number. So to give 10 gigabytes a user to all 5,000 users, we've got 50 terabytes just in user disks. Mm-hmm. Now, what's that network load look like? Because this is where it gets interesting, because we just moved a bunch of traffic off local disks onto the network. And as it works out, it's about 30 gigabytes per second to support 5,000 users. So our overall load now, we've got to be, and you know, the majority of that stays in the data center, and it's just going between the storage and the virtualization hosts, 30 gigabits, on top of what we already saw for access to user disks and things like that. So a couple of cool things. We talked about CSV block cache in the last module. By turning that on, in effect, by turning on just a 1 gig cache, so allocating 1 gig of RAM on those file servers as cache, we saw a cache hit of 80%. So we reduced the IOPS by 45% when we could hit the cache for that.
Just by taking 1 gigabyte
mm-hmm.
of
just
RAM.
Just by allocating 1 gig of RAM on the file share, you can see how effective that caching is. Because basically we're just caching that gold VM. All those reads that normally were hitting the gold VM, we can just pull out of the cache now. The nice thing about that is if storage is our bottleneck, just by turning on that cache, 20% increase in the number of machines we can run under simulation before we start to hit those VSI max, things got too slow and laggy.
Okay.
Solution.
So you're able to pile on more machines mm-hmm. per and get more density.
Right.
Okay.
And that's really, I mean, your cost savings with VDI all come in density. How many users can I get per server?
So just moving. I mean, the thing here, I want to make it clear. You gained additional density simply by moving away from local disk storage over to SMB storage and adding cache, a gig of RAM worth of cache,
yep.
Now have improved that density.
Yeah.
Okay. Awesome.
It's cool, right?
Yeah, that's really cool. It's like, okay, now all of a sudden, and this SMB storage is not super expensive, as we talked about in the last module. Mm-hmm. You can get to SMB storage relatively cheaply.
Yep, and we can just keep adding spindles. We can even, you know, and which is going to be cheaper than solid state, but by adding more spindles, load balancing that across that array, we can start to get some of these benefits there.
Very cool. Very cool. So, yeah.
So that being said, what are some of the tweaks you can do on this? We could still use solid state for those gold VMs. And you can see there's a trade-off there. So which is better? Do I use solid state for my gold VMs, or do I use the CSV cache? And you can kind of see the trade-off there. If you're at memory capacity on that server, if those file shares are already kind of bumping up against the RAM that's in them, you're better off using solid state. But if you've got the RAM available, use the cache. Turn on the cache. It's free. It's there. It's not a more expensive disk you have to buy.
Right. And a lot of times, RAM's a commodity that may sometimes sit on a server, right? Mm-hmm. Particularly when you start looking at file servers.
Yeah. File servers, a lot of disk I/O, not a lot of RAM activity. So generally, that RAM is there and available for use.
Okay. Awesome.
So, and again, we talked about load balancing, the scale out file server solution.
Yes.
Load balance that against multiple. Corey even used this command. It's like he knew what slides I was going to show. Talking about that move SMB witness client PowerShell command to enable that scale out and load balancing.
Okay, so now let's mix up things, because using pool desktops, you're not putting nearly as much workload. I mean, you are putting workload on the storage, but you're not having to keep and persist things nearly as much as when you have to do personal desktops.
Right. So, yeah, it's a nice thing, you know, with if I'm doing 100 desktops in a pool, I've got a 20 gig master and a 5 gig differencing disk for each of those 100. If I'm going to do 100 personal disks, I've got 20 gig times 100. My storage costs just went way up.
Yep.
Now, as a result of that, what did users get? Full personalization. Whatever they could do on a physical PC, they can pretty much do in their VDI image now. They want to install apps, fine. We can let them do that if we choose to. So there's advantages to personal. The trade-off is in we got a whole lot of disk space we got to solve for now.
Okay.
The other thing that's interesting is when we're doing VDI pools, we've got that hotel, we've got those 35 machines in our instance that are just virtualization hosts. Those don't need to be clustered, because if a VM goes down, user just logs back in, they'll get allocated to a machine on a different server. Their user profile data was stored on a share somewhere, so they just log back in and keep working. With personal VMs, if that physical host goes down, we got to fail those over somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have a little bit of a change in our environment in that all those virtualization hosts now need to be in a cluster. Can you put 5,000 machines in a cluster? Yeah. Server 2012 supports
sure,
up to 8,000.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Up to 8,000 high availability objects. So that's not a problem. Now we're talking about 150 VMs per host. How many hosts can we have in a cluster? Can we have all 35 of our machines sit in a single cluster? Yeah. We actually can go up to 64.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not hitting any limitations of Hyper-V in terms of what we can put together here. And otherwise, this is a pretty similar scenario to what we did for all pooled VMs. We got all of our data sitting on two SMB file servers that are clustered and set for configured for scale out.
Okay.
So we have a little bit of change in what the load is here. Remember, this is a mix. We've got 1,000 users in personal disks instead of in the pool. So now they've got their own I/O happening. The pooled VMs, those numbers don't really change. It's pretty much the same as we saw before. Lots of read traffic on the gold VM, a little bit in the differencing disks. But now we've got these pooled machines, which don't get to take advantage of that gold VM anymore. They're full installations, not a differencing disk. So they've got a bunch of their own read and write I/O.
Yeah, and you notice that read and write, you know, that's for the personal desktop, you know, 6,000 reads, 4,000 writes. So you're starting to bump up that I/O.
Yeah, again, that 10 IOPS per second times 1,000 gets us to this 10,000 IOPS we've got to solve for now. We've got to put those
somewhere. Okay. All right.
And in our case, we're going with that SMB share for where we're putting those. So, first of all, we got to figure out the storage problem. We've got 1,000 VMs. We got to store, you know, say 10 or 20 gig per. Well, that's 100 terabytes of storage just there, plus rating it, so it could be double that. And then our pooled VMs, again, that storage just stays the same as where it was, 20 gig for the master plus 5 gig per. Differencing disks and user VHD, again, at 10 gigabytes per user. Now we only have 4,000 user VHD disks because everybody else has got a personal disk, so that storage goes down a little bit. But you can see the totals there went up significantly by going to personal VMs.
Yep. And then what about network traffic?
And the network traffic gets exciting because now those personal VMs are all hitting that SMB network as well. So we've got a bunch of extra traffic brought on by those.
Okay.
Our total gets to about 34 gigabits per second.
Okay.
So not significant, actually not significantly higher than it was before. We have more storage, but about the same amount of traffic going over to it.
Okay.
It was 32 or 33 gigabytes a second when we had 5,000 pooled. So converting 1,000 of those to persistent disks wasn't a significant increase in traffic.
Okay, so what do you really need to do to tweak and kind of optimize in this environment?
Well, there's a couple things you can do. If you can reduce the amount of space used, if you've got a SAN that supports block-level disk dedupe, and we're going to have those 1,000 personal VMs, which effectively are probably, what, 90%, 80% the same data in all of them?
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you've got a SAN that can cache that, can take care of disk dedupe and compress all the identical data, we can reduce some of the storage space required.
Mm-hmm.
We don't do online disk dedupe on storage spaces, but a lot of SAN solutions do.
Okay.
So we can take advantage of that.
All right.
The next thing I want to talk about is the vGPU, because I saw some questions about this in Q&A. People say, hey, you know, we do have some 3D accelerated apps, some DirectX apps. We want to put GPUs in our server. How's that affect this solution? So if we took an ATI Fire, what we did is we took an ATI Fire Pro card, and we put it in a server with 128 gig of RAM, 4 gig of RAM on the card. This chart that we're showing here, it's a little bit different. When you use RemoteFX and you configure virtual machines to take advantage of that shared GPU card, you actually set a resolution that it's going to send in the display. And that reserves, when you start that VM, it reserves that RAM on the GPU.
Okay.
So this chart basically says, hey, if you want to max out, give everybody the highest resolution supported by RemoteFX and multiple monitors, you can see that each one of those users is going to allocate 268 meg of RAM in this case. So what we found is when we assigned smaller numbers, we found we could get about 70 users per Fire Pro. If we put two of these cards in the machine, in our case, we ran out of memory because it was only 128 gig machine. But in the previous example we talked about, if you could throw these cards in there, basically two GPUs, two of these Fire Pro cards, would give you enough GPUs for all 150 of your users.
Okay.
See about 140 as possible.
Okay. All right. And the only reason you capped out there, again, you just ran out of physical memory.
Yeah.
At that point.
On the hosts. Yep.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. So a quick recap on the various deployments that we have, and I think this is pretty critical to do, just because, again, these numbers can be used as we continue down the path, right? So you can scale up as high as you want, but can people use these numbers to build out even their smaller level solutions? And what is it that we should start? What is the math? Like, because this is the chart, right? This is the diagram that really does that.
Yep. Here's your summary right here. You know, figure out how big your base VM is. If you're going to do a pooled VM, then it's just that base plus 5 gig per. If you're doing persistent disks or personal disks, it's that base VM times number of users. Storage, we know, is about 500 kilobits per second. The RDP traffic is 500 kilobits per second per user. The storage numbers we had there, so you can kind of calculate what your network load is.
Mm-hmm.
But everything, you know, and setting aside a couple of separate machines to run all that infrastructure, the broker and things, but this gives you an idea where to start solving for.
Now, the only time you needed to really get into clustering is when we started talking about bringing in those personal desktops. Mm-hmm. Because before that, you just had probably one piece of physical hardware. You ran two VM sets that ran the brokers and everything else like that on a single physical box. You didn't need to cluster that. When we bring in those personal desktops, obviously, I can't have a piece of hardware go down and my user's desktop not be available to them.
Right.
Okay.
Yep. So that's for that farm of virtualization hosts. You're going to need to cluster those for personal disks so that a user can always get to his desktop even if a physical host goes down.
Okay. And finally, these are a couple of important things. I know you cover these quite frequently. I hear, I'm always asking you, what are the top few things that you hear from folks? I want you to cover off these two items before we hit the next break.
Okay. Yeah, so that's always the question is, well, what is our scale here? You just showed me something that scaled to 5,000 seats. Here's the deal. Our admin UI, the inbox admin UI, which you guys spent a lot of time in earlier in module 2, I think.
Server manager.
3. Spent all this time in server manager. That UI was really designed for 500 seats. We figure that's a pretty common use case that'll address a lot of users. Now, what happens when you get to 501 seats? It still works. Comes into 1,000 seats, it still works. Mm-hmm. We've tested it up to 5,000 seats, and it works. But
air quotes.
But you know, think about that environment. It shows, you know, how many active users do I have, and there's a list box that just lists here's all the active users and which machine they're connected to. When you have to populate that list with 5,000 machines, it gets really slow. And then when Joe User calls and says, "Hey, my machine is hung. Can you reboot it for me?" I have to scroll that list of 5,000 and find his machine. There's pretty rudimentary filtering and sorting there.
Yeah.
And if five users call and say, "Can you reboot our machines?" I actually have to do them all one at a time. There's no multi-select in there. So management becomes cumbersome if you've got 500, if you've got 5,000 seats. Now, the thing is, if I'm an IT administrator for a 5,000 seat deployment, I probably want to automate a lot of stuff. What was it you said earlier today that you love? You love redundancy. What did you call it?
It typically comes down to repeatability, right?
Yeah.
If I'm going to do it once, I'm going to assume that I'm going to do it multiple times. So I'm going to get that PowerShell out, right?
Yeah. So that's what we say is, hey, 500 seats. You know, I'll make it more vague. If I've got hundreds of seats in my deployment, the UI is a great solution. If I want to do thousands of seats in my deployment, I'm going to have a better experience with PowerShell. And the good news is, if you're managing that many seats, you probably automate a lot of stuff anyway. So hopefully it's not a huge jump for people, but it is something to be aware of. Those are kind of the limitations of the UI. If somebody says, "Well, I don't want to learn PowerShell and I have 5,001 seats, what do I do?" That's a great segue into introducing our partners like Citrix, which I know they're really our primary partner in this space. There's some other great companies out there as well. But that's the other question I always get when I present is, do I still need Citrix? And the next session is really going to be all about the answer to that question. When do I need Citrix? What do they bring to the table on top of the great solution you've been talking about all day here?
Okay. Awesome. For those of you who have asked in the Q&A panel, the company that we use for the performance testing tool, it is LoginVSI. So that's LoginVSI.com. I posted a link inside of the Q&A. So for folks, if you're watching this recorded, LoginVSI.com is the place to go and get that tool. And that's essentially kind of where that was the main tool that you guys use for your
backup. Yeah. And it's not just like I said, if you go to HP or Dell and say, "I want to buy a VDI solution," they will say, "Hey, here's these machines and here's their login VSI specs for these machines." Mm-hmm. And if you look at really anybody that's got a VDI solution or a session hosted solution, it's sort of become the de facto standard for how do I tell how high I can scale.
Awesome. So we are coming up at the end of this segment. How about, I'm going to drag Corey back on to talk about Citrix, but you come back at the end and we'll talk more about licensing.
Okay.
Sound good?
That'll be a big gear switch. We've been doing all this propeller head stuff, and now I get to talk about airy licensing.
But it's really important, and people need to understand how licensing works. I've seen a ton of questions come up today as we've gone through the day about various licensing types, so I'd love to have you back to do that.
Yeah, there's three questions I always get when I present, and I've been doing, I've been the VDI guy for a year and a half now. Do I still need Citrix, which you're about to find out about? The other one is, are you guys going to do an iPad client? Which I say, well, you should ask if we need Citrix still. If you have a lot of iPads, you might need Citrix.
Yeah.
Or one of these other companies that you can get from the App Store for your iPad client. The third question I get is, can you explain the licensing to me? And my answer is always, I'm sorry, we're out of time. But I guess you've got me trapped here for
an hour. We're out of time now, but I'm going to have you come back in about an hour.
All right.
All right, guys. More on the using Microsoft VDI to enable new work styles. We've got Citrix and their partner solution coming up. Stick around.